This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Okay, let's get started. So we're down to the final theme, a different kind of fear, and this will be the shortest one of them all, but I think the best one of them all, and so we got maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. So we're looking at how the assembler has engaged the tragic and the joyful in the fear of God. So now we're in the fear of God. I call this a different kind of fear because typically fear is understood as something quite negative. Negative emotion that, an unwanted emotion that diminishes our lives, steals our joy even. So you put the fear of God together and you're like, oh, that doesn't sound too appealing to a lot of people. Unless you're a thrill seeker, right? An adrenaline junkie, you get how fear and joy can come together. So if you ever climbed a mountain and you get to the top and you're looking out, you know, whoa, you feel that fear and joy come together in a very intense way. And so you see that they're not necessarily opposing all the time. They can come together. And there's that emotional cocktail again. These emotions can come together in potent ways. My first experience of the fear of God happened around the time when I was reading Ecclesiastes, and that was part of it, in fact. And I had experienced the fear of God as both something you're supposed to do, you're commanded to fear God, but also something that can come upon you. I think the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, comes and gives you the fear of God. It's also a gift. And so I felt this when I felt it as mostly an awakening to God's presence, to His Word, and to His coming judgment. That's what I was being awakened to. I was pretty much blind to these things, numb to these realities. And this awakening wasn't all pleasant, of course. It was an awakening to, therefore, my own sin and my urgent need to change. That was certainly part of it, part of the pain in some ways. But mostly it felt like an awakening to me. And this only intensified when I read the Gospels and the words of Jesus. I felt the fear of God become very poignant to me. And it came to the point that I felt what William Faber wrote in this hymn, The Fear of God. My fear of Thee, O Lord, exults like life within my veins. A fear which rightly claims to be one of love's sacred pains. See that mix in there? But like life within my veins. That's how I felt the fear of God. So it didn't narrow my life by any means. It broadened it. It awakened, it ignited a love for God and for people and God's creation that wasn't there before. That's what it did to me. So I don't have a negative view of the fear of God. I don't think the scriptures do. And I don't think the assembler does either. And this is a theme, a big theme of Ecclesiastes. A scholar has called Ecclesiastes the supreme song of the fear of God. And I hope maybe you see some of that. Not just the ending, but all the way through. The fear of God in the Old Testament is basically a term for true religion, for true spirituality, if you've read Francis Schaeffer's book. And the wisdom literature talks a lot about the fear of God, and it calls it the foundation of wisdom, or the beginning of wisdom, especially in Proverbs. And now, if you say beginning of wisdom, you might think, oh, you start with the fear of God, and then at some point, you leave it behind. So it's a good thing to start with, but it's not something you want to stay with. Well, no, that's not the idea. The idea is more that it's like a foundation. It's what you start with, like when you build a building, but then you build everything on top of that. You never leave the foundation behind, or everything comes crumbling down. That's what the fear of God is in the Old Testament. But that's never rejected, I don't think, in the New Testament. So there is a passage that's used that makes people think this, 1 John 4:18, where it says, love casts out fear. But that fear is qualified. It says the fear of punishment is what's being referred to there. So it's not saying the fear of God is being cast out now, because it's really important to see fear of God isn't fear plus God. That's not how you understand the fear of God. The fear of God is a phrase that has its own meaning. It has connotations of fear, but it's not the same as just taking what we understand as fear and then adding God to it. That's why I want to say a different kind of fear. And I think even Jesus qualifies this. Well, before Jesus, Paul uses this term, and he doesn't disregard it. He doesn't say, you know, we're moving on from the fear of God. It's part of his understanding of being a Christian, even. So he says, 2 Corinthians 5:11, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. Or 7:1, bringing holiness to completion in the fear of God. Or a more famous passage, Philippians 2:12, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And this is what Jesus says too. He doesn't talk about the fear of God, but I think he sure does in other ways, not with using those words. That was my experience. But here's what he says in Matthew 10:28. Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can both destroy the soul and the body in hell. Those are some hard words. That's the kind of power God has. And that should give you a healthy respect for God, to say the least. But then he immediately qualifies it, right after. He says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are numbered. Fear not, therefore. You are of more value than many sparrows. Jesus, he's like the assembler, right? Fear him. Fear not. So this is not a fear that we are afraid of God's character. Right? We can have a holy awe for his love, as well as a respect for his power. So this is a fear that doesn't cause us to run away from God. This is a fear that causes us to draw near. Maybe with fear and trembling. But still we draw near. So the fear of God certainly connotes respect, reverence, awe. And John Goldengate, in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, says, you know, the Hebrews didn't have these different words for fear and for awe. And so he chooses to describe this as the awe of God. He translates the fear of God as the awe of God. And so it's this Godward orientation of holy awe towards God. And yet fear, I don't want to let go of that yet, because it's a potent word. It's stronger even than awe. And I think that's why we need to keep it. It's, you know, when you have fear going on, you are focused. And so I think what fear of God means is that we give God our attention more than anybody else. It means that we listen to his voice more than any other voice. It means we rejoice in him and his works and his words more than anybody else's. He gets our ultimate attention. And that's what's going on with the fear of God. And it's not the opposite of love, but it's something of a synonym for love. This is what scholars are looking at more and more in the Old Testament especially. So listen to this, what Moses says in Deuteronomy chapter 10. I don't know if I have this. Nope. Deuteronomy 10, 12 to 13. And now, O Israel, what does the Lord require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord, which I am commanding you today for your good. That language right there, fear God, obey his commandments, that comes in right at the end of Ecclesiastes. But here, fearing God and loving God, they're not pitted against each other. They're in the same sentence of how you are to rightly relate to God in this. And so you could almost say, fear God by loving him, serving him, obeying his commandments. That's certainly how it ends up at the end of Ecclesiastes. Fear him by doing this. So, here is again Faber. But fear is love, and love is fear, and in and out they move. But fear is an intenser joy than mere unfrightened love. So it's this aspect of the fear of God that's emphasized, I think, in Ecclesiastes. So the joy of the fear of God. Fear God by rejoicing in the good gifts he's given you. That's what's going on, I think, in Ecclesiastes. To rejoice with trembling, as the end of Psalm 2 puts it. Serve him with fear, worship him with fear, rejoice with trembling. That's how the end of Psalm 2 puts it. There's that cocktail. And here again, Faber. A special joy is in all love for objects we revere. Thus joy in God will always be proportioned to our fear. I think the assembler would say, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. So again, I think there's a perception in Ecclesiastes that what we have here is life without God. At least until we get to the very end. And that until then, God is absent or totally distant, but barely mentioned. And if he's mentioned, it's only in negative ways. Now, there are negative descriptions. He says, you know, God has given us a tragic task. The word is raw, which could be outright evil or it could just be bad. I think tragic is the main meaning of raw in Ecclesiastes. God's given this. But I think what he's saying there is God's given us what comes after the fall, what we read in Genesis. Cursed is now your work. You got frustration in your work. That's what God has given us. But in Ecclesiastes, you'll see that leads you eventually to joy and eventually to God. That's another story. But is God absent in Ecclesiastes? Any guesses on how many times the word Elohim, the word for God, is mentioned in Ecclesiastes? And not including pronouns, not including other words like creator. What's just the, you know, don't guess what you think I'm going to say, but what would your first gut response be? Five. Okay. Anybody else?
37.
12. More than any of those. 40. The word God is mentioned 40 times in Ecclesiastes. So he's not absent. The assembler is running into God at every turn. He's turning his head. There's the vapor, but there's God doing something and giving something. So yeah, vapor is mentioned 37 times, but God gets 40. And I don't know totally what 40 might mean, but it's more than vapor. So he's not absent. And what's he doing? It's one of the main things God's doing. He's giving. Giving, giving, giving. He's giving days. He's giving us gifts. He's giving us joy in our hearts. And what was the number, Joshua? How many times is
28.
20 times. So Ellen Davis mentions how this giving is mentioned 28 times. And that's what Bubs said.
Four sevens.
So I don't know. You know, maybe we're making too much of the numbers. But there's a lot of giving going on here. And this morning we looked at these seven Carpe Diem passages. the seven joy passages. Carpe diem means seize the day. And Uni Lee says this: every one of his commendations of enjoyment, without exception, is grounded theologically in the affirmation that this life and all its incumbent joys are a grant of God, or in the hand of God, or from the hand of God. That's something to pay attention to. So we're moving now from the seven joy passages to the seven times that the fear of God is mentioned in Ecclesiastes. Three of those are in one passage, so we're going to move through these a lot more quickly than we did this morning. This is the first one. We're going to spend the most time on this one, and then we're going to move quite quickly through the others. So chapter 3, 9 to 15. This comes right after there's a time for every season passage. What remains for those who make from their toils? I have seen the task God has given the sons and daughters of Abinadab to be humbled by. He makes everything beautiful in its time. He also puts eternity in their hearts, without which no one can discover what God makes from beginning to end. I know there is nothing better for them but to rejoice and do what is good in their life. And what is more, the fullness of humanity, that they would eat and drink and see good in all their toil, this is the gift of God. I know that everything God makes will become eternal. There's no adding to it or taking from it. And God makes so they would fear before him. Whatever is has already been, and what will be has been before, and God will seek out the pursued, or God will seek out what slips away. That's another way you could interpret it. So what remains for those who make? So we make things, and God makes things. So that question isn't just directed at us, I don't think. I think it's meant to be, all right, all the people who are making stuff, including God, what remains? So when we look at the work of our hands and the work of God's hands, well, we make sandcastles, and God makes what is eternal. So what remains for us? Nothing. Only things remain in light of what God makes. He makes things that remain. And because of that, we should stand in awe of him. That's a frightening difference between us. We are a vapor, and he is forever, as that song puts it. And that should cause us to stand in awe of him. We're mortal, and he is not. That should cause us some fear and trembling when we really encounter that. He makes so that we would fear before him. He set this thing up the way he did so that we would fear and tremble before him with rejoicing. So he does what we cannot. He makes all things beautiful in their time. All things, the crooked, the ugly, what's gone, he's going to make it beautiful in its time. He makes things eternal. So that should cause us to fear before him, to be in awe. It says he puts eternity in our hearts. That forever thing, as Cormac McCarthy puts it, that forever thing he puts in our hearts. I think it's like that flash of eternity he puts in our hearts. And that should give us awe for him and awaken us to him and his presence. And it's this eternal thing we encounter that gives us understanding about the work of God from beginning to end. You need to taste that and feel that to understand actually how different and incomprehensible the work of God is from our work. Two very different things. We're made in his image, so there's something like us in God, but there's also something very different that we should pay attention to and stand in awe of. So his works are beyond our comprehension, beyond our grasp, beyond our predictions and control. He works in mysterious ways, so that we would fear before him. And I think this is very similar to what Paul says in Romans 11 and Romans 11:33. So up to this point, you know, he starts out with people sinning, and then God giving people over to sin, and you're thinking, what the heck's going on there? And somehow that leads to faith in Christ. And at the end of it all, Paul's like, oh, the depth and the riches and the wisdom and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. That's what he's saying all the way through the book. That's what the assembly is trying to say, that very thing. How unsearchable are his judgments. How inscrutable his ways. Not that there's nothing revealed about God. The assembler says things about God and what he's doing. But at the same time, this is a mysterious work. And so for the assembler, you start out with God giving us a tragic task and the toil. And then this leads to joy in our hearts at points. And then this leads us to God. And so I think the assembler is saying, whoa, how unsearchable are his judgments. Unscrutable his ways. So they're mysterious and generous is what he sees. So if we have eyes to see, we're going to see him giving us these gifts to us. The nothing better gifts of rejoicing, of doing what is good here, the gifts of human fullness, of eating and drinking and seeing the good in our toil and all that means. That's the gift of God. That's what he's doing in the midst of his mysterious ways. So that, yeah, he makes what he makes, he does what he does, so that we would fear before him. So that we would stand in awe. So I hope you see here, this is not some joyless terror for the assembler. That's how he's presented sometimes. This is a fear that rejoices in God's gifts. Down to earth gifts, like food and drink. Meaningful work, companionship. And we're due to do this not far from him or hiding from him, but before him. It's the good before God. It's those who fear before God. That's what he's talking about. Coram Deo, before the face of God. So our attention is on him and his works more than any other. With just hearts and hands open, receptive, ready to receive what he wants to give us. So in a sense, we're awed to heaven as we're rooted in the earth. So Brueggemann, the title of one of Brueggemann's books puts it. We're awed to heaven and rooted in the earth. It's very sacramental, we'll see. Maybe we have seen. So I hope that at this point, again, you see, it's not about let us eat and drink for tomorrow we die. But I hope by the end here you'll see this is, let us eat and drink in the fear of God, for tomorrow we die. And that makes all the difference. Now there's one more work here that we're supposed to stand in awe of, that's mentioned at the end, that we can rejoice and hope with, I think. It says earlier, everything God makes will become eternal. Well, you see a problem here. What God makes is eternal, becomes eternal. If we're vapor, there's a problem, right? That means we're not eternal yet. God needs to do something. So this isn't some full-blown thing of resurrection going on, but it sure prepares the way for it. It's a hint at it, I think. So it says here, God, therefore, will seek out the pursued, or seek out what slips away. This is like shepherding language. What do shepherds do? Well, when their sheep are getting lost and pursued, they slip away. They go and get them. They find them. That's the type of language that's going on here. And so this lends support to the ending where it says the one shepherd gives the wise their words, that this one shepherd is God who seeks out what slips away. In the book of Ecclesiastes, what's pursuing everything and everyone is death. Death is pursuing each of us, is overtaking each of us eventually, where each of us is slipping away. But God seeks out what slips away. So I think with this is not, again, a full-blown doctrine of resurrection. You rarely get that in the Old Testament. If you do, I think there's a hint here. And I think in light of the resurrection, we have an amazing image to pray with. Because how many good endeavors, how many legitimate joys have slipped away from us? My hope is God's going to seek those out and raise them up, and that there's going to be some place for them in the new age and the new creation. So this should cause us to fear before him, I think. So to fear God is to pay attention to him and to rejoice in his works more than any other, to hear his voice more than any other. That's what comes next. This is chapter 5, 1 to 7. Keep your feet as if you were going to the house of God, and draw near to listen, rather than offer the sacrifice of fools, oblivious to the evil they do. You must not rush upon your mouth, and your heart must not be hasty to bring forth the word before God. Indeed, God is in heaven, and you are on the earth. So let your words be few. For the dream comes with too many tasks, and the voice of a fool with too many words. When you make a vow to God, you must not delay to keep it, for there's no pleasure in fools. Keep your vows. Better not to promise than to break a promise. You must not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, and you must not say to the face of the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry with your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Even in the midst of so many dreams and vapor and endless words, even so, fear God. So, again, you can see here, the ending is fear God. This whole passage is meant to be, this is how you fear God. And it's not about running away from God or hiding from God. It's when you draw near to the house of God in order to listen more than to speak. So the temple, of course, or the house of God, this would reference the temple. And the temple was where the Torah was and taught. A Jew would know that. The Torah being the scriptures, the law. This is where the priest would speak the Torah and teach the Torah. That's where you would go to hear it. So to listen to God in his temple, in his house, would be to listen to Torah. To listen to the scriptures. And to listen in the Bible, it's another way of saying also to obey. To obey what you're hearing. You don't just listen and say, oh, that's interesting. It's kind of like, you know, when a parent says, weren't you listening to me when they disobeyed? They meant, how come you didn't obey me? Well, that's the Hebrew understanding. Sometimes it's translated either way. So here you see a connection with the rest of the scriptures. So I do think, again, as the Ecclesiastes was this kind of gateway for me to the rest of the scriptures, that's what it's meant to be. This is the assembler pointing you to the rest of the Bible. Listen to the whole book. Not just what I'm talking about here. He's got his own particular thing he wants to highlight. His own particular command. That's to enjoy life and live it to the fullest. But here, he's saying, listen to God. That's more than better than anything else. And I think if you read this, a lot of maybe other passages come to mind, like James 1:19. Be quick to listen and slow to speak. That's a lot. That's a summary almost of what's going on here. Or when Jesus says, when you pray, don't keep babbling like the pagans, for they think they're going to be heard because of their many words. And then when he talks about oaths, he basically says, just don't do it. Let your yes be yes and your no be, you know, be no. Better not to make a promise than to break one. Because we are prone to empty promises and empty chatter with each other and with God. So let your words be few. And even in the midst of so much of this endless talk, even so, fear God. Remember who you're talking to. Whose presence you're in. He's on in heaven, as Jesus even taught us to pray. Our Father in heaven. It's meant to be reverence. Remember who he is. He's the eternal one in heaven. Even though he's also present here on the earth, he's still our Father in heaven. Remember that. So listen up. Listen more than talk, I think is the idea here. Because he's also intimate too. This is someone you draw near to. Actually, John Goldengate told me this when I was emailing him about a translation. He said, the Jews had an understanding. God could be in heaven and in the temple at the same time. They had this dual sense. He's both transcendent and immanent. So he's someone we can draw near to, even though he's in heaven. And we can live before him, even though that's the case. And I think here, this is really interesting. Keep your feet as if you're going to the house of God. So that's not in any of the translations, but I talked to John Goldengate about this and said, look, this word, I see this as if in the Hebrew, but I don't see any translations. And he said, it's a possible translation. He said, it's translated that way in other places, not with this specific understanding, but that word can be. And so if that's the case, then this is a very sacramental view of prayer all of a sudden. So it's not like just when you go to the temple, but keep your feet as if. You're always drawing near to God. You're always living before his face. That would be a big deal. But I don't know if that's totally true yet. But that's that's how I maybe understand. That's how it fits for me with the rest of the book. So fear him, to listen to his commandments. And the commandment in Ecclesiastes that you're supposed to listen to, that's the unique one of Ecclesiastes, is live life to the fullest. Rejoice in what God has given you this day. Which leads us to the next passage. I have seen everything in my days of vapor. There is a righteous person lost in their righteousness, and there is a wicked person lingering in their evil. Don't get consumed with being righteous, and don't consider yourself overly wise. Why destroy yourself? And don't get consumed with doing what is wicked. And don't be a fool. Why die before your time? It is good that you should hold on to that. And also to never let go of this. That the one who fears God comes forth from all of them. Or another way, he comes forth with all of them. That's another way. So this passage has troubled interpreters for a long time. And the best take I have heard is from Bruce Waltke. It goes something like this. To be righteous is to be someone who denies yourself for the sake of others. You're willing to do that. That's one of your practices in life. You're willing to say no to your own desires at times for the sake of others, for the sake of the community. The wicked person is willing to please themselves at the expense of others and the community. Okay, so that's kind of the two things. So the idol of the wicked is pleasure. And they're willing to do whatever it takes. Whatever, they're willing to compromise morally, whatever they need to get the pleasure. And yeah, for me, that was my teenage years. So I get that. And they can linger there too long and become addicted. And destroy themselves, die before their time. You can't live beyond your days. You only have a certain number of days. You can die before your time, but you can't live longer than your time. That's not something. Even Jesus, that's what Jesus said. Can you add 1 hour by worrying? Nope. You've got a limited number. So that the wickedness or the idol of the wicked is pleasure. I think the idol of the righteous can be righteousness. Doing what is right. Sacrificing all the time and only sacrificing. And they can get lost in this. I think they can destroy themselves with this. And I had a season of this too as a Christian. And it's a real joy killer, to say the least. It reminds me of this illustration I heard one time, and I've used this in our workers' meeting before, about a mother baking cookies for her children. And, you know, here she is, she's baking these chocolate chip cookies for her little daughter. And imagine her little daughter about to receive these cookies, but then saying, no, I can't take the cookie, you know. life's about sacrificing, and I just care about you, Mom. I don't care about these cookies. I don't need these cookies. And no, God wants you to take the cookie. He made cookies for you. You went to a lot of work, and you're meant to eat them and enjoy them. I think that's what the assembler would say to the righteous lost in their righteousness, who don't know how to receive good gifts from God. Because the one who fears God doesn't linger in either of these things. He's not destroyed in these ways. They're not, the one who fears God doesn't worship righteousness or pleasure. He worships God, or she worships God. And she escapes all of these things because of that. But also the one who fears God comes forth with all of these things anyway. You come forth with righteousness and pleasure at the same time. So that's what's being presented here, I think. And they know also that there's a time and a place where God will make things right. And that's what comes next. I know that God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there's a time and a pleasure for every work. That's 3:14. And then there's this, which we looked at already. When those who miss the mark do evil 100-fold, and there is length to them, nevertheless I also know that God will come to those who fear God, that good will come to those who fear God, who fear before him. And good will not come to the wicked, and they will not lengthen days as a shadow when they do not fear before God. So that's his bigger picture. That's what he knows is coming down the road, even though at the present, you don't always see that. I know this will be the case, even if it's not the case right now. So yeah, we don't know when or how God does this kind of thing, when he's going to play this out, but we can rest in the fact that he will. And that rest can give us a kind of peace and even a joy that can make us non-anxious people in an anxious world, a non-anxious presence, as a friend of ours says, in an anxious world, when we trust God is eventually going to do this. If you don't have this in view, if you don't have God's ultimate judgment in mind, that he's going to eventually sort all things out, then you're going to live possibly a very frantic life, a life of panic. And it's all up to us right now. We better do it. And that doesn't produce life. And actually, it inhibits people from actually changing. But when you can rest that God's going to work things out, you can actually get on with real living. That's what the judgment should do for us. So we can trust in that. We can say that there is grace and there is wonder coming on the way. God will make things right. And so then we can even start to rejoice in the wilderness, because he's going to do that. We can rest in that. And that brings us to the final one. This has been called the kernel of the book. And I think that's true. I just think the song of the fear of God, the supreme song, I just think it started way back in Ecclesiastes. It didn't start right here, if you see those other passages. The end of the matter. The fullness has been heard, or all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is human fullness. For God will bring every work into judgment, even every hidden thing, whether good or evil. And we can talk more about the bits of interpretation that I've done here. Mostly this is just how it sounds in the Hebrew. But right before this, it says, to the writing of many books, there is no end. And I don't think the assembler, Ian Proven, points out, he's not just saying there's a lot of books out there, but that the writing of a lot of books has no end goal. There's no end to them. They got no point. But not this book. This book's got an end goal. And it's the fullness of humanity. And what is the fullness? It is to fear God and keep his commandments. For this is human fullness. This is what it means to be whole. In the Hebrew, it just says, for this all total humanity. And so people fill in the duty. This is the duty. Duty is not in the Hebrew. People don't know what to do with this. And I think the best way to understand that this is, Peter Enns helped me see this in his commentary, for this is human fullness. So Dick mentioned a week ago this saying attributed to Irenaeus, the glory of God is humanity fully alive. And here to be fully alive is to fear God and obey his commands, for this is fullness. This fear exalts like life within my veins. And so it's a fear that awakens us to the living God. It awakens us to his life-giving commandments. It awakens us to his judgment. And that should, of course, motivate us, that judgment. But it also, again, should free us to live. Because we know he's going to turn every wrong right one day. One day he's going to seek out every good thing that has slipped away. He's going to make all things new and good and beautiful one day. And through the merciful judgment of Christ, he forgives us and he's going to raise us and our works from the dead. So God's going to take care of that. We can rest in that, which should free us to obey the unique command of this strange and wonderful little book to take up our portion, right? To eat and drink and to see the good, to be in the good, to see life with the one we believe, with our beloved, to cast our bread upon the water and rejoice with trembling before the face of God. May it be so. Amen. Thank you.
Nikki.
Last passage that you had, the slide that we left off on, and had two versions of fullness.
Yes.
That was my question that I was holding.
Yes.
So I was wondering if the word for, in Hebrew, for the fullness and human fullness, if that's the same word. Like, is this saying the completeness of my wisdom has been proclaimed to you? And that same word is used in the human fullness, or if those are two different words in Hebrew?
The same word in Hebrew. It's
okay.
Kal, is how you pronounce it. And it's all through the book.
Okay.
So I don't always translate it as fullness, but depending on the context. Especially this one, the human fullness, there's this phrase, Kal Adam, which typically in the Bible means everyone. And that's at least what it means. But Peter Enns highlights this phrase in Ecclesiastes is only used four times. It's used once here, and then the other two times are in one of the joy passages, or in the joy passages, and then one in, this is the end of everyone, or this is the end of fullness. So he thinks, he's pretty convinced that it's tied to the eating and drinking and the fullness of what's being described there. So it's a double entendre. Kind of deal. Because in the Hebrew it's fear God and keep his commandments, for this, there is no is in Hebrew, but a lot of times you have to fill that in depending on context. This is all or whole of humanity. And so you could say this is for everybody, or a lot of people fill in with another word, but I think the whole idea of the whole book has been human fullness, human flourishing, and that's what's being said here. This is the culmination. So that's, but this is all. So it's interesting that, you know, the all has been heard. And so it's probably, you know, that's what I'm understanding as what's being referred to here. The fullness has already been heard. And here it is. Fear God and keep his commandments. But it could, that first one could just mean everything's been heard. That's another possibility. And it's the end of the word, actually. Word can be translated like the matter, the thing at hand, or it could be word. So it could be the end of the word, the whole thing is a word, or this is the end word that you're about to hear.
Because this book has an end.
Because this book has an end, yeah. The end of this word. There is one. And here it is, if you didn't get it by now. Joshua.
Just to, the name Ecclesiastes, what is that? What's the order? Because it, what is that exactly? Yeah, I mean,
yeah, that's the, from what I remember, the Latin version just means assembly, mm-hmm. because the assembler.
Yeah.
So it was basically a translation of assembler,
okay.
and so that's ecclesical, ecclesiastical, but that's the idea. But the Hebrew means one who assembles, so it's very similar. But it gets translated. It got translated as teacher or preacher because, well, he's talked about as the one who taught the people knowledge at the end, and so this could also be understood as someone who teaches in an assembly.
Mm-hmm.
Which is certainly what he is described doing at the end, but he's assembling more than that. He's assembled words, he's assembled buildings in chapter 2, he's assembled themes that we don't think normally go together. And of course that's also the image of like herding the wind. Try to assemble the wind. It's pretty possible.
So, but the Hebrew name would just be the assemble, like the or a straight translation of the name would just be like,
yeah, assembler. And Trevor Longman says that, in his view, in the most recent thing I've read from him on this, that the assembler is the best word we could use to translate this Hebrew word. The first time I read it, though, was from this Buddhist guy who translated this book, and he used the assembler. And I was like, oh man, that sounds so good. And in fact, that's the meaning of the word. But he had a very different take on vapor. So he loved the vapor idea, but he hated the idea of God. And so he just, every time it came to God, it would just be reality. Oh man. When he came to the main part of the book, he didn't want any place for a personal God, a creator. But he got the vapor part, kinda. And so I think there'll be similarities in this book with, I think even in Christianity, Buddhism will sometimes travel the same road for a certain degree. And then there's a fork in the road. And that was definitely a fork in the road for me when I was reading him. But assembler, that's the more basic meaning of the word. And people don't know, is it, was it a title or was this, a name? At some points it says the assembler, other points it just says assembler. And it's interestingly, it's in the female form throughout the book. But then it's always paired with a male, a masculine noun or a masculine verb, when there's a verb to it, except one place, and that's at 7, the one in chapter 7, where it says the assembler. This is again, the narrator comes in, and right there, it's a female version of the word. It says, she says the assembler. And so you're like, wait, what? and so Ian Provin, he has a hypothesis that maybe the author was a female. And this was a hint. And this is right at the spot where it says, I found a woman who was a trap. And then I also found these 1,000 men who weren't with the women. So it would be pretty funny. She's making a little appearance, if it was a female author. Because a female author at that time would be... It would be pretty hard to be a female author, I guess, even in the Bible at that time. I don't know. I mean, that's a conjecture, maybe, but it's pretty interesting. Why, commentator, what do we do with this? And so that's Ian Provin's guess, is that maybe this was a hint.
Do you have a date on, guess date on? You hadn't mentioned date before.
When it was written?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the majority of scholars... beyond just conservative scholars would date it to be about 300 BC, around there. But Ian Provin says, even the dating is guesswork, because you could still have the book written quite earlier and then an editor or some editing or new words given 300 BC. So just because there's words there that were prevalent at 300 BC doesn't mean that's when the book started. That might have just been its final form. So I'm pretty agnostic myself on when, but the majority of the views say around that time. I know Trevor Longman argues for a much earlier dating, so it's hotly debated. But yeah, it's Persian words that are the cue to people to saying this was written much later than when Solomon was alive. So they're like, well, it couldn't have been written by Solomon. But yeah, we just don't know, really. I mean, there's nothing conclusive other than those words. So we had a question. Oh, yeah.
So going to the fear of God, there was a verse that we read that said something along the lines of, to those who do evil or those who do not do good, they toil and give to others, or God gives to others, or something like that. And so my question was, when it comes to like the relationship between fear and punishment, it seems as my question would be, the punishment from God, could there maybe authors, like I remember when I read Mere Christianity, it seemed like C.S. Lewis described hell almost as an automatic consequence of certain people's decisions to be separate from God, mm-hmm. and rather than seeing hell as, you know, something that God makes happen as a form of punishment,
yeah.
at least with the understanding that I got from the book.
Yeah.
So would you say that maybe the author here has that view of punishment, or would you say that maybe fear of God could also take into the consideration that side of punishment, as in, if you do not obey, you will be punished for this disobedience, or is kind of like a natural consequence, like God built the world in such a way that if you don't fear the Lord, these consequences will come upon you.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on kind of the problem of evil, and or even, yeah, how much responsibility is ours, and how sovereign is God over his created order, and how involved does he stay in the curse? I mean, that's, you know, some people say, well, the curse that you read about in Genesis is merely God just describing what's coming because of what you've done. That God wasn't involved in the curse at all. He didn't make that happen. It was purely what Adam did. And I'm just living up the consequences. When I read Genesis there, I see God more involved in that. And in my view of the scripture as a whole, God is more sovereign and involved than just saying, you're just living up the consequences of your choices. I think there's something of that. I think, of course, you're living up the consequences of your choices. But, and I think that's part of the struggle of God's work in his mysterious ways is, oh man, he's doing this. So how do we still affirm his goodness or something in light of that? And so I would think that, yeah, the emphasis in Ecclesiastes is God is the main actor, in fact. You know, that doesn't exclude our acting, but the emphasis is more on this is under God's dominion, in a sense. It's everything's in his hand, coming from his hand. And so you know, this one person before God will receive these from him, and the one who sins, or the one who misses the mark, even what they have, what they have will be given to the other person. It sounds very similar to a phrase of Jesus, where he says, you know, to the one who has, more will be given. And to the one who doesn't have, even what they have will be taken away. And so I think that principle is one that Jesus even picks up on. I'm not sure if he's interacting with Ecclesiastes or not, but I think it's also a bit like, you know what? If you don't pick up your portion, it's going to go to somebody else. I think that's part of the idea too. Like, you know, God's not going to hold out his gifts to you forever. It's, you got to turn around and take up your portion while you can. You know, Jesus says those kinds of things. You know, live by the light while it's around. One day it's not going to be around. So don't just sit around on your butt. Put yourself in the right position to receive the gifts. And I think in the New Testament, of course, there's a greater urgency because it's about salvation. And, you know, Paul will then say, today is the day of salvation. So it's urgent because there's bigger issues on the line than just enjoyment. But...
Do you think that Jesus interacts with Ecclesiastes directly anywhere?
It's hard to say that about anything. No one thinks there's a direct quote, but the verses I've brought up, I think, are meant, I think Jesus interacted. So when he says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and when he says, and wisdom will be proved by her deeds, I mean, that seems pretty close to interacting with Ecclesiastes.
Her deeds? I mean, female author.
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, lady wisdom.
But that, yeah, people think Paul maybe is pulling off of that word and the phrase, the passages I've quoted from Paul. Especially James, the book of James. The more I'm reading James, I think it's totally interacting with the book of Ecclesiastes. And that's the conviction of Jeffrey Myers, who wrote A Table in the Mist. And he's written a commentary on Ecclesiastes. And guess what his next commentary is on? The book of James. So I'm hoping when he writes that he's going to bring out more of those connections. But I think a lot of the verses I shared, it seemed like whoever wrote, the author of James was very much aware of some of the stuff in Ecclesiastes. But there's no, direct quoting that I can tell, but I just think the themes are present outside of.
Even the wedding at Cana, I mean, this like, I think I left the room when you quoted the Son of Man comes eating and drinking, but that he kind of starts his public ministry by bringing joy and drink to this big human party that's about marriage. I mean, those are some of the major things in Ecclesiastes. It's like, enjoy your spouse, enjoy your food and your drink. These are good gifts. That Jesus comes on the scene is like, yes, these are good. Yes, these are good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the only liturgy that Jesus has left us is communion. Is gathering around a table with bread and wine. Very basic human things, ordinary things. Mm-hmm. And this is the table in the midst. the spread, I mean, that's for me, it's the Psalm 23 that... He's spreading this table in the midst of your enemies. And that's what Jesus is doing for us in this age. Enemy number one is death. The valley of the shadow of death. And so, but I don't think that's just him interacting with Ecclesiastes. That to gather around a table has been a Jewish thing way before Ecclesiastes was written. But I think Ecclesiastes comes out of that. So to eat and drink for a Jew, to say that, is implying especially festivals and celebration and really celebrating the festivals of God, which Ecclesiastes doesn't outright mention, but it's interacting with them in that, and when I said, wear your white clothes at all times, that's what your white clothes, bright clothes would be what you would wear for a festival. And so he's breaking out of the festivals. He's saying, not just the festivals anymore, all times. I'm getting away from Jesus' interaction, but yeah. Michaela.
We talk a bit more about God seeking out what slips away and what do you think that means for us? Like what are those things?
It's not like it's spelled out, of course, in Ecclesiastes. But in my view, it's anything he thinks worthy is worthy of resurrecting. Mm-hmm. Of course, everything that he will make new is going to have to pass through his judgment, his fire. It will need to be refined and made worthy of the age to come. But in my view, he's the good shepherd who seeks out the lost sheep, of course. the sheep of his hand that no one can grab out of his hand, he says. But I also think It's the good works we give ourselves to that slip away and that, in our view, come to nothing sometimes. Mm-hmm. We do things that are in the Lord and unto the Lord, and we don't always see them bear fruit. Mm-hmm. Yep. And they seem to fizzle out. And I don't think Jesus is going to let that remain the case. Mm-hmm. With anything, any good endeavor we've given ourselves to, especially ones that we've done in him and for him in his ways. And so that's my hope. Mm-hmm. My hope is he's going to seek all that out, mm-hmm. Every joy he's wanted us to have that slipped through our fingers, he's not going to let that remain that way. That's where my imagination goes. Sarah?
I am curious about Ecclesiastes' placement in the larger body of scripture here, coming after Proverbs, before the Song of Solomon. And you, Joshua, have just been sharing with me your discovery of, in the Song of Solomon, the language of desire being picked up for the first time since the curse.
Hmm.
In scripture, and something very different is being said about the nature of desire in Song of Solomon versus, you know, in the curse, your desire is for your husband who will rule over you. And I guess I'm curious about both because of this theme of taking joy in the good gifts of marriage and life, and also something of like, coming to the end of wisdom or experiencing the limits of wisdom,
yeah,
and where that leads you, exhausting what you can do, exhausting yourself, exhausting the resources that humans have, and then sort of where that leaves you hungry still, and what it leads you to long for, and then this coming of Solomon, and to whatever extent that can be read as a vision of Christ the bridegroom and his church, and of course the goods of human marriage. Anyway, that's a lot, sort of verbally processing, but I am curious if you have thoughts about Ecclesiastes' placement between Proverbs and Song of Solomon, and then also, I think, along with this, you mentioned that it was read during the Feast of Booths. And, sort of, what are we meant... what is that meant to do in you? Like, to read it during that, those festivals. And there's the connection, I guess, to this. But you can pick up wherever you want. Sorry, or not at all.
Yeah, well, I think definitely I was trying to allude to that early on when, you know, if it's in the wilderness, Ecclesiastes is meant to be read when life is upside down or when you're experiencing the opposite of what you're hoping for. And you're living in these little shelters, and Jacques Ellul kind of talks a lot about, like, all your possessions are supposed to be in there in this little thing, but you're also depending on God to provide for you in the wilderness. And like, so the manna coming down, and this is a terrible situation, but it's not totally terrible. God's providing. And so to look for that and to trust him for that daily bread, in a sense. I think that's part of what the Jews maybe understood in reading this during the Feast of Booths. And also it was a time for hospitality. Yeah. You're supposed to entertain strangers, and it still goes on today. And I think that's especially, there's a progression of that through Ecclesiastes, where it's like, oh, one of the worst things you see is this one without another. No brother or child, and he's working all for who? Mm-hmm. And then two are better than one. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of that one, it's like, actually two and maybe three. Mm-hmm. And then the cast your bread finally. It's what about seven or eight, you know? And it's like, this keeps adding up. And that's like the sharing your bread. I think they get maybe that's what Ecclesiastes was talking about. That was the earliest interpreters understood, cast your bread upon the water, as that being generous with kind of reckless abandon, almost. So I think that's something. But to do that, to practice that in the wilderness, to practice sharing your bread, so your bread is your life, like, you need to live by your bread, and to say, I'm going to cast that upon the waters and give that and share that with abandon. That takes a lot of faith, and that means you trust God to be one who's going to provide for you, even when things look terrible, even when, you know, everything's upside down and death is on the way, and to say, oh God, you gotta take care of me. I don't need to like fret about that and be all stingy and hoard. Mm-hmm. It takes a particular faith for that. But one more thing about you mentioned wisdom, and this is Jacques Ellul makes a big deal about this. He thinks like the pretty late reading. He thinks the Ecclesiastes was written with a lot of interaction with Greek philosophy. And so when it's talking about wisdom, he's jabbing at the philosophers who have way too much confidence in their wisdom. So that's why he's wanting to talk about the limits of wisdom. And like, all right, you want to be wise and stuff, but wisdom's not going to save you. You know, your best philosophy is limited and it won't keep you from dying. And he's never like, well, therefore don't be wise. He's going to redefine, I think, wisdom too for philosophers and say, in his own way, the fear of God is the foundation of wisdom. But I think he's doing that. He's interacting with, there's a lot of evidence that he interacts with the literature of his time, from Egypt to whatever was available to him. And then there's evidence that he did stuff with it and was correcting. And so there's the ending, it says, and this remains, it says in fact, because the assembler was wise and he taught the people knowledge. It said he listened and searched out and straightened out many proverbs. And so that's exactly the evidence we have, is that he was listening and reading and searching out, but he did stuff and he corrected. And what's really interesting is that word straightened out, it's used earlier in the book when it says, nobody can straighten what's crooked. And so, you know, the only way you could straighten something crooked then is if God helped you to straighten that out. And I sort of think that's another affirmation of God was involved with this assembler. But also it's it also is an example to us. If we want to listen to and learn from and straighten out the wisdom of our culture, we're going to need divine help. Only God can do that kind of thing. And so we should depend on him as the assembler did. Yeah. Ben?
Oh, I don't know whether it was a thought or not, but it just occurred to me when you were talking that is there a connection between viewing all your possessions, including your bread, as vapor? It's all temporary, it's all fleeting, it's all going to be gone, and then the exhortation to be generous with it. Is there a connection there or not? I don't know whether that's... like, whether we can conclude that the assembler is saying, listen, you know, you're all going to die.
So
you might as well just share what you have. I don't know whether I was reading into that or not, or what, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That might be a connotation or a sense, but I don't get that, like, kind of fatality. Like, death is definitely... in view and coming, but if that was, you might want to hoard if you're like, oh man, I need to survive. Right. But to give away your very means of survival to your neighbor, that's a huge thing to ask. In light of all that he's been saying all along,
right.
Unless you're cueing into, you should be trusting that God is giving you gifts all the time with his hand,
right.
And so you can trust more's coming. You don't know how and when, and you have to depend on him. But it was just like, yeah, the manna. I mean, they had to, they couldn't hoard a bunch. They couldn't, you know, have to be like, well, this manna is only going to last for a day.
Yeah.
So I'm going to trust God for manna for the next day.
Just so you're going to vapor isn't enough, I don't think, to motivate someone to share, to be generous.
Yeah, exactly.
There has to be something more, a sense that it's a gift.
Yeah, and Emily, she goes... I mean, super far in this, she thinks that the assembler sees enjoyment as integral to the fabric of society. Because without this view of enjoyment that deals with contentment and working with your portion, your limit, then what goes on is greed and consumerism. And that's going to ruin society. So we need this view of enjoyment in order for society to be good and wholesome. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, I'm still coming to terms with that. I don't know if it's still there. That's her understanding. Ecclesiastes, so it's making me reread it again. But Anna.
Yeah, it also makes me think what Ben was just saying. I've been really convicted by how, like, what a big deal it seems to God that when the Israelites were, you know, freed from slavery, leaving Egypt, wandering, but also headed to their home, that the other nations didn't help them. But God obviously thought that was a really big deal, that these places that they were kind of sojourning through, he has some really harsh things to say about the nations who refused to help this wandering person, that they should have shared with Israel, and they didn't. They hoarded for whatever reason. And I have been, just struck by and convicted by those passages. Like, it is a big deal to God that we share, that we cast our bread upon the water, even when it feels like there's not enough. And I'd rather keep this for myself. That he takes that to be, a really beautiful, important part of human existence.
Yeah.
So I kind of agree with you, and I like that.
And like in the Feast of Booths, you're...
Exactly, you to bring in the stranger.
The stranger, even. What's so not even your brother or sister. What's
that movie we watched about the Feast of Booths?
It was so good.
It's like a modern celebration of the Feast of Booths in Israel. And this Jewish family has to bring in some people. Has anybody seen that?
And he's so upset with who the guest is.
Yeah.
Remember, like, he's just like, oh! Like, there's just, like, this real life, like, oh, this is not working well, and why this one, God? Like, he's like, you know, could have been anybody, but why this guy? And then by the end, they're friends and stuff by the end, but it was a real journey and beautiful movie in light of this. It was very
is it
human.
An Israeli movie? Is this the movie?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we watched it, like, 10 years ago, or... It was so good, though.
Can I say one more thing?
One more thing, and then I think Marty and Nikki.
It's just a story that I thought you were going to tell, but since you didn't. I've told a bunch of you this, actually, already, but a few years ago, we were at a concert in Switzerland, and it was Sufjan Stevens. Ooh. He was touring his Carrie and Lowell album, which is a really heavy wrestling with death and vapor, and obviously... He's been very influenced by the Christian faith. And one of his songs, I would encourage you to find it. I don't remember what it's called, but just has this refrain, "We're all going to die," that he says over and over and over again. He sings at this kind of pitch in the song, "We're all going to die." And we were in a huge auditorium. Hundreds of people, obviously big Sufjan Stevens fans. They all knew all the words. And we're all just singing, "We're all gonna die." And in the song, he maybe repeats it 4 or 5 times, but I am not kidding you, he sang that probably for 15 or 20 minutes.
What?
And hundreds of people just like screaming, "We're all gonna die." And it was an incredibly sobering, powerful, bizarre, and somewhat beautiful experience of just like, and people spoke all kinds of different languages in this auditorium. They knew the English lyrics, and we all just had this, 15 minutes of realizing my life is a vapor. I'm a vapor.
Yeah.
But it was...
It was powerful. Really, oh, man, it was profound. Yeah. I mean, it was really... It stuck with me. I'm glad you brought that back up. And, of course, there's a book that you could read. I got this actually at the National Conference when we were there. I don't know if you guys know this guy, you are from Nashville, but it's called Remember Death, The Surprising Path to Living Hope by Matthew McCullough. Does anybody know that? He's a pastor in Nashville. But this is an excellent book on this very topic that we're a culture that is in denial of death, and to really come to terms, not just with death generally, but with my own death that's coming.
Yeah.
It's very hard for us to do that. It's always been hard for us to do that, but especially in our culture, and he helps you come to terms with that. And he talks about, he's talking about, like, you get these survivor stories, and he says, but you know what? Nobody's a survivor. He's like, it's just like somebody falling off a building, and you might catch them at some point along the way, but eventually they're hitting the ground. Nobody's a survivor. Everybody dies. And we don't, we don't live in light of that. And so he mentions actually how, you know, the older churches, we were just talking about this, how they would have this, the cemetery, something you have to walk through on the way to church. So you remember where you're going. And that really clarifies things. And our church, our new churches aren't like that at all, right? You know, where is the cemetery? I don't even know. It's somewhere far away that we have to deal with. But I think we should have cemeteries right in front. Maybe we should have one right up here. I don't know. But we need that reminder, I think. That's clarifying. And I think, but I think especially Christians, I mean, if we have the resurrection as our hope, you know, we should be able to face death without fear, even not without emotion and not without anger, but we could have hope. We should not be avoiding death of all people. Mm-hmm. Of all people.
Mm-hmm. This Sunday is All Saints Sunday, where you remember the people.
Yep.
Yeah. Ask the forgiveness.
Yep. Exactly. But I would recommend this book, especially on, and of course he interacts with Ecclesiastes. But, Marty.
Yeah, given all of the message, particularly the second lecture on joy and the commands to joy, the whole positive view that you've described really so helpfully, I just want to mention a couple of verses, which I wonder how you see them fitting in, or whether there's major translation issues here. So, toward the middle of chapter 2, where he says about the wise and the foolish, the same fate befalls them all. So I said to myself, well, this is vanity, and so I hated my life. And then he goes on and said, I hated my toil, which is kind of negative. And then at the beginning of chapter 4, where in a sense it's even harsher, talking about the oppression and the evil in the world, with people being oppressed with no one to comfort them, and I thought the dead who have already died more fortunate than the living who are still alive, but better than both is the one who's not yet been, who's not seen the evil deeds that are done. In other words, it would be better if we hadn't even been born. And it just, that, I mean, I know you've talked about the clash of these things, but do you see that as those really negative things, negative about life? It's better if I'd never been born, or if not that, that I died already, rather than an affirmation of life, an affirmation of joy. Just how do you see that going together? Or is there a big already I've seen lots of translation issues.
No, I don't think there's any translation problem there at all.
All right, so how do you fit it all together?
I think for me, that's his lament over what's wrong. And so the first one, I mean, that where he says, it says, I hated life. I don't think it says I hated my life in the Hebrew, just I hated life. And I hated my toil. It does say that. But I think what he's saying there, I mean, that's the strongest one. I have the biggest problem with that one out of the whole book in my reading of it. But I think what he's saying there is, I hate the tragic element of life. So he's, in that context, he's encountering the death of his life work, the death of joy, the death of his own approaching death, and he's saying, I hate that about life. That's how I read that part. And so it's his emotional response to what's tragic in life, in my view. It's his lament, but he never says to us, commends us to hate life. He doesn't say, oh, you know, now you should hate life, but he's just like, I hated this about life. Because in the end, he's like, life is sweet. You know, life is sweet to the eyes. It's good to see the sun. So he's saying life is good, but he's also saying life is tragic and broken, and he hates that about it, I think. And then about the oppression, again, that's one of the strongest ones. I would say this is poetry, too. So he's saying something, he's trying to say how wrong this is with as much poetical force as he can. And it's kind of like Job, you know, when he started to suffer, he was like, I cursed the day I was born.
Right.
And that's kind of like it was an honest response. And I think it says in Job, up to that point, he had not sinned. So it wasn't like his, I wish I wasn't even born because of this terrible suffering, that he was wrong in expressing that grief in that way. Again, I don't think the assembler is calling anybody to suicide or saying, you know, your life's so bad, you might as well call it quits. He never says that.
No.
But he's so upset about oppression. And he's so upset about, here they are, the oppressed, and look at their tears, and there's no one there to comfort them. I mean, that's what he's so upset about that. And I think when you see that, when you see there's no one there to comfort them, you want to say, that's so wrong. You want to use the strongest language that you can. You say, that's wrong. And that's, I think, that's how I read what comes next. But even Jesus, you know, he says about Judas, it would be better that he was never born. Like, that kind of language is not foreign to the rest of the Bible. But in context, I just think it's just his lament and his anger at what's wrong. That's how I read it. But I still find them jarring. And the very ones you mentioned, those are the hardest ones for me and for anybody, I think, to read in Ecclesiastes. So I understand your trouble with them. They've troubled me.
I think this is a translation issue. I'm thinking of 3:11. You have it up here.
Yeah.
Because this is what one of the things that has keyed me into a more of an existential understanding of things. The two translations I've got at hand on verse 11, 3, he has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive there's nothing better for them to do than to be joyful as long as they live and so on. In other words, he's put eternity in there. Animals don't have existential issues, crises. We do because we have eternity in our hearts. And yet, he's put, this what this translation says, he's made it, we're incapable of knowing what God is up to. Mm-hmm. Now, you've translated completely differently. And I'm wondering what the translation issue is there. Because that the way this reads, it fits beautifully into existential literature because we've evolved to a place where we have an infinite imagination, and that infinite imagination has no contact point in a materialistic world. Mm-hmm. It's just empty, comes up empty, vain,
yeah,
so on. And so God is has done us dirt by planting eternity in our minds that has no fulfillment, no connection in the world that he's made for us.
Yeah.
Or God in quotes. How does the translation work out?
Yeah.
You translate exactly the opposite.
Which verse?
Well, I don't think it's exactly opposite, but this is without which no one can discover. I've got a hold of the most recent, very, very technical grammar work on Ecclesiastes. And so these guys, there's 3 or 4 scholars who said this is the literal rendering of that phrase.
Because it does mean the opposite. I mean, in the sense of the... putting eternity in their hearts, as you've translated it, is what gives us the possibility of knowing that God, the God who knows beginning from the end.
Totally different, totally opposite.
Opposite or not? Right.
Well, I think it is. It starts off opposite, but it gets pretty close to the same in that what you discover when God puts eternity in your hearts, what you discover is how mysterious God's ways are. So what you know is how beyond your grasp they are. And because he does, throughout the book, highlight again and again, I think that's why I brought Paul's, I don't know if it's the next one, this. How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. I think that's a refrain all the way through Ecclesiastes. And you know that when he puts eternity in your hearts, when you encounter the eternal in your heart, you know something about God. And what do you know?
Yeah.
You know this. You know that. So I think they start out very opposite, but I think they end up in a similar place. Go ahead.
Sorry. With Paul says, he's building that on, in all that you do know about God, beginning from the end, there are limits because He's ultimately unscrutable.
Yeah.
Because Paul is leaning on the whole revelation that's been given, all the New Testaments that we do know, and I tell you about them, I've quoted them, all this stuff. Here, I'm not sure. And again, how I've read it, and again from the more existential perspective here, is that means you understand what comes following as
there's nothing better than to just work your day, get your calluses, eat your food, and put all these big questions out of the way. Forget the distinction of being a human being with an infinite approach to big questions. Forget about the big questions, what you're beating on your brain, but nonetheless forget about them and be content with your daily life. Now, that's the way the other side, the other reading would run.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a possibility. I don't want to rule that out. But I think, you know, the ending here are, he makes so that they would fear before him. So I think it's more about awe and mystery and wonder at what God is doing instead of, I can figure all this out. I got God figured out. I know what he's doing from the beginning to the end. I know, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. I know why a good day is coming versus a bad day. I mean, a lot of his emphasis is on, you don't know what's coming down the road. I mean, whether it's going to be a good day or a bad day, whether you're going to die or not, you don't know, and God's not going to tell you. that's a mystery. And so I think that's the sense I get. You know, he does these things so that we would fear before him and be like, whoa, this is an awesome mystery and wonder. But he doesn't say nothing about God. There's things you know and there's things you don't know. And what you do
especially
know...
Especially when you have the whole book.
Yeah.
Especially when you have the whole book and you're like, he's emphasized as the creator. He's emphasized as this giver of good gifts. He's an enabler. But he's also giving you hard things. He's not just giving you nice, easy things. He's giving you a hard task. He's humbling you. He's going to pursue. He's going to make things eternal. And so I think, and then just like Paul, I think Paul is emphasizing the things you can know about Paul, or you can know about God. Here's the revelation, and yet this is all beyond us too. There's a limit to what we can know, and I think that's constantly what the assembly is doing: is what are your limits of knowledge, and what can you know, what can't you know? But yeah, I mean, I can see your read, and that could, you know, you could definitely go that way.
Which fits into a different paradigm as well, but the trouble is, it's all a different lens.
Yeah. 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 I wouldn't say that it's just totally off base or something. Or lots of smart, godly people have read it that way. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't want to write that off. It's not possible. Yeah. Nikki, and then...
I'm sorry if you already answered this. I missed the tail end of the discussion last night. But I was wondering if you could tell us about the distinction between the use of Elohim versus Yahweh.
Yeah.
I'm guessing, I don't think I've seen any of like the Lord's, which is normally what we get in English with Yahweh.
Yep.
I think I've only seen God. So I was wondering if you could shed some light on that, particularly given that Yahweh often has like the connotation of a more personal God that is uniquely covenanted with Israel,
yep.
And versus this maybe seemingly distant use of Elohim.
Yeah, yeah. This is, there's only three books in the Old Testament that don't have the name Yahweh, and this is one.
Okay.
And Song of Songs is one of the others, and then Esther. But then Esther has it in acrostics. So it's in there.
Interesting.
And so the favorite rendering of God in Ecclesiastes is the God. So Ha Elohim. And so people think what maybe was intended, the book of Ecclesiastes might have been intended for a wider audience. And so for beyond the borders of Israel. And so we're talking, and just in case you're wondering, we're talking about a the God. And just in case you're wondering, I'm also the King of Israel, and I'm also referencing you to the temple and to his Torah. Because, you know, when you go to the house of God, and what's in the house of God is the Torah. So so it could be, the hope is eventually you're going to get to Yahweh. but maybe all you know about is the God, the Creator. And that's, you know, at the end he's called, or he says, remember your Creator. So that would be a more, you know, accessible term for a wider audience, probably. And that's my conviction. I mean, has not that been what Ecclesiastes has been for people? How many people have come into the scriptures because of Ecclesiastes? That's their entry point, because it's written in language that's not typical maybe of the rest of the Bible, and it seems addressed to a wider audience. So that's my guess. That's what some other people's guesses are. And that in some ways it's like a very well put together tract. Maybe that's not a great word, because tracts have a really bad rap and they're really cheap a lot of times, but it's not cheap. It's very intricate and very thought through. But that's what some people guess what's going on. But that's also, if you take a negative take, you're like, well, this guy's not even talking about Yahweh. And so I would take that as a point for the negative view. But there's also other ways to think about it. That's how I think about it. The answer is that.
Yes, I mean, I just want to know your insights and research and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and then Ben, sorry.
I think an additional point interesting to that is, I don't know if there's a correlation or not, but in the book of Acts, there's a lot of reference to, like, God-fearer, right?
Yep.
Or a person who fears God, but yet is not under the covenant of Israel.
Yep.
And Luke, if I'm not mistaken, in his gospel, he goes all the way back to Adam in Christ's genealogy, as opposed to Matthew, I think, only goes to Abraham, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the idea is that Luke, in writing his gospel, he had in mind a wider audience as well. And the book of Acts, too, has, you know, it shows that, you know, the gospel would spread throughout the whole world.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was wondering if, you know, even the relation that Ecclesiastes has to Genesis, you know, and how it would, that's just an interesting point. Just thought about the fear of God being something that goes beyond covenant, and almost as if, you know, everyone can reach this fear of God, and then this fear will lead them to this kind of special revelation.
Yeah. Yeah, and if people have done research as far as fear, the fear of God or of the God, that was a broader term in the ancient Near East. So that wouldn't have been foreign to other people. But how you define the fear of God would be different. So the Jews, their definition of the fear of God was very specific to their scriptures. And especially obeying the commandments of God. You know, it's very, a lot, so many times, fearing God and obeying His law are side by side. And so that's one of the distinctives of the fear of God in the Jewish culture. So going, you know, draw near to His house to listen rather than babble. And just, you know, think God's going to hear you because of your many words. Know what your first priority is go and listen. Listen to what He said, what He's saying. And so that's where I think, again, if it's made for a broader audience, it's like, all right, we're in the language of the fear of God, but let me remind you, I'm King of Israel. And in Israel, we have a temple, and we have Torah. And that's where I'm directing you to. That's what I see going on in the book. And so, yeah, this book is not meant to be where you finish. It might be your entry point, as it was for me, into the Bible, into the world of the Bible, but you're meant to go from Genesis all the way to whatever was written at that point, and now we've got a lot more to read. Ben, and then...
Just about, do you see a similar form or like progression that is in some of the Lament Psalms, in which you have, you know, sort of Walter Brueggemann's thing of like disorientation, reorientation, orientation, disorientation, reorientation, in that the heaviest, what you described as the real laments in the beginning of the psalm, the passages Marty was referring to about like, I hated life, that is just sort of the raw expression of grief and frustration at injustice in the world, and then sort of a gradual deepening of perspective. In the way that, you know, in Lament Psalms oftentimes, that, you know, the heavy-hitting stuff is freighted towards the beginning, and then there's some sort of change in perspective,
yeah.
And then usually remembering what God has done and who He is, and then a new kind of element of hope. And I don't know whether there's something similar going on as you read it in terms of how it ends,
yeah,
as opposed to how it begins.
Yeah, well, I think this is something Uni Lee mentions, but for her, it's not like there's a switch point when you've transitioned from what's kind of more negative to more positive, mm-hmm. but that each of these themes gains an intensity and remains side by side the whole time. So even like, when I was showing you that last passage on death,
right.
I mean, that's like overwhelming. And then, but joy is increasing too, right alongside that. I think purposefully though, but also to be like, here's death in all its fullness, but joy is right here too. And then we end up with the fear of God in the strongest expression of it in that final chapter. So I think the fear of God is meant to be the final word. Yeah, the final word is another way to say that. That God gets the final word on vapor and everything. And so I wouldn't see, because I see Psalms, like, there's a lot of, like, man, there's a dire situation,
yeah.
And then God, you came in and turned things around,
mm-hmm.
and now I'm living in that. And right. So that's unique to the Psalms. I don't see that as much in Ecclesiastes, that kind of pattern. But it's more, I think Ecclesiastes is more about holding these tensions together in one life, and learning how to do that, because we tend to, depending on our personalities, we like to gravitate towards one of these more than the other and flatten out the other ones. Maybe one or two more. We're getting tired. Maybe one more, or maybe that would be it. Okay, let's say that's the end.